Nirvana is the giving up of everything, and Nirvana is my heart's goal. If I am to give up everything, then let me give it to beings. Let me give my body to them, to do with as they wish. Since I have given it to them, why should I care what they do with it? Let them do what they like, whatever brings them pleasure, but let them suffer no misfortune because of me. Let them hate me, let them love me, but whatever they're feeling for me, let it bring about all that they desire. Let them wrong me, let them mock me, let them accuse me falsely, but let them share in enlightenment. So these extraordinary verses of aspiration are from chapter 3 of the Bodhicharyavatara, the chapter called Bodhicitta Parigraha, which means something like grasping, seizing or embracing the Bodhicitta, fully accepting the Bodhicitta into Shantideva's life. That's what he's doing here. He's fully accepting the Bodhicitta into his life. And you really get the impression that the verses are recited or composed under the force of tremendous inspiration. And we're going to try and see what that feels like as the retreat goes on, because we'll actually recite some of these verses in forthcoming pujas. And they're verses of real wisdom and insight. They're not just inspired. Shantideva sees that nirvana, gaining enlightenment, which is his heart's goal, the goal of the Buddhist life, will involve the giving up, the renunciation of everything. Because nirvana is the end of all craving, all attachment, all aversion, all confusion. That's why nirvana is said to be peace, shanta, supreme peace, the complete pacifying of our conditioned, clinging being. Those three shantis at the end of the puja, as I've said sometimes in the evenings. You know, what we're doing there is actually opening up to nirvana. We're opening up to that deep, fathomless, vibrating peace. And that's why it's so important to sit as still as we can at the end. Try and get a sort of flavour of what it means to have renounced absolutely everything. But giving up means giving away. Giving everything away to others. I don't think you can really give up unless you give away, really. It means giving away. And Shantideva expresses that in the aspiration to give away his most cherished possession, his body, his personality even. He just gives it away, gives it up to others. They're very, very strong words indeed. And they're really rather frightening, actually, when you really contemplate them. I must admit, throughout this series of talks, and whenever I look at a text like the Bodhicharyavatara, where there's this emphasis on this tremendous altruism, I always feel even very fraudulent. Doing something wrong in a way, because it's such a sublime ideal, which I'm nowhere near getting anywhere near to. And yes, there's this frightening kind of altruism that's involved. And I think it's actually very, very hard to imagine that kind of ease in relation to oneself, that you can just give it up like that, give it over, give over your life to serve other people, however they are to you, however they treat you. Some of you will actually complain about these verses in the groups. You'll be saying, look, that's just over the top. You know, what about self-metta? That's what you'll be saying. I'm not going to let others walk all over me. You'll be saying that, I can guarantee it. But if you think that, you've really misunderstood the nature of Shantideva's altruism. He's not a masochist, nor is he ridden with guilt and self-hatred. Shantideva is speaking, singing from the Bodhicitta, which is a vast, selfless consciousness. He's in touch with something so big that really he cannot be diminished by how others treat him. That's impossible for him. It might look to us might look to other people that he's being used and humiliated and diminished. But that's not his experience, because he's in touch with something so much greater. There's actually a lightness to these verses, I think, and we need to say them lightly. And this reminds me of someone called Ahmad Sham. Ahmad Sham, of the leader of the Ahmad Sham Sufi Qawwali group from Kabul in Afghanistan. And they're a very good Qawwali group. I heard them on the radio on World Roots, which is a very good programme. Good old BBC, so good. Very, very good programme. And they, of course, were asked what it was like when the Taliban came to Kabul. How were they treated? Because, of course, the Taliban banned music. They regarded music as haram, you know, as evil, as bad, as not what the Prophet wanted, enjoined. And Ahmad Sham said, in our Sufi tradition, we have a saying, when the roof is taken from the house, it's fully open to the sky. And when you are being broken, El-Haq, the truth, Allah, enters you fully. So the more they beat us, the louder we sang. The more they beat us, the louder we sang. And he was chuckling as he said these words. The louder they beat us, the harder they beat us, the louder we sang. So it's rather like that. They're in touch with something so great, they can't be diminished. The more the bodhicitta shines, the more you can give to others. But you're not really thinking that you're giving, actually. It's more like singing and dancing and celebrating and playing, even feasting. I say that because at the end of chapter 3, and of course it is a time of feasting, isn't it? At the end of chapter 3, Shantideva says, for the caravan of humanity, travelling on the road of life, hungry for the enjoyment of happiness, this is a feast of happiness offered as refreshment to all beings who approach. Today I invite the world to Buddhahood and to all kinds of happiness. In the presence of the Buddhas, may gods, titans and all rejoice. Shantideva wants people to join him in feasting in the Dharma. Buddhahood is a feast, a celebration, something you know, and a feast and a celebration, of course, is something you do communally. Feasting in India, of course, is a very important communal activity. And, you know, that's why it's such a powerful metaphor, I think, in the book. You know, I've lived in India and been part of the Buddhist community. And, you know, the community really comes together for a good feast, to enjoy, to celebrate the good things of life. You know, it's, you know, and you know, when you're invited to a feast, if you're a you know, every guest is an honoured guest, you know, you sit down and it's a real event, and it's served very beautifully, and by the women of the house, by the way, who are not at all diminished by that. They have a wonderful kind of elegance and great sort of dignity in the service. And you eat and you talk and you joke and you reminisce. And afterwards, you know, you usually sit around and have more serious conversation. It's a wonderful way to come together. And you take time. You take a long time at the feast. So I find it very interesting that Shantideva uses this metaphor because of the feast. Because the question arises, how does a bodhisattva operate? What does he do? How will he act? Now, we've seen various general activities and practices and attitudes. But how will the bodhisattva operate in the world? How will he act in the world? And I think that metaphor of feasting gives us a clue. The bodhisattva creates community. The bodhisattva creates spiritual community, either by fully participating in an existing spiritual community, or if necessary, creating a new spiritual community. And by community, I don't mean simply living together, living with other people who are committed to the bodhisattva path. Although bodhisattvas will most likely do that, they will live with other bodhisattvas or aspiring bodhisattvas. But it's more that the bodhisattva creates, keeps recreating a body of people spread over the world that is dedicated to the bodhicitta, to raising up the bodhicitta, to developing and strengthening the bodhicitta for the benefit of all. And the community the bodhisattva creates, of course, is a dynamic community. It's always growing. It's always reaching out to more people. It's not an exclusive community. It's not a clique. So the bodhisattva knows that he cannot do his work alone. He doesn't want to do it alone. He's not a kind of superhero who sort of comes into a situation, sorts everybody else, and then goes back into his sort of lonely superhero up there status. He wants everybody to participate with him in the feast of spiritual community. The bodhisattva thinks, in fact, that the community, the spiritual community together, is the bodhisattva. That it's that's really what's going on. A spiritual community really it should be a community that's touched and moved and motivated by the bodhicitta. Sangharakshita has said that it's much better to think of the bodhisattva as a spiritual community rather than as one person. And it does seem that Shantideva himself created something new. He left Nalanda, that's what the legends say. Maybe because it was well established and people had what they needed. But as far as we know, Shantideva wandered after that, particularly in South India. And it sometimes describes that he wandered among people with strange beliefs. And some people describe this as, well, these are tribal people, people who live in the jungles and the forests, who are generally regarded as outcasts, who would have been regarded as outcasts by Indian society, who are not deserving of culture and religion and spirituality, a spiritual path. He lived and worked among them. He taught the Dharma to them. He accepted them as his hundreds and hundreds of them. In other words, he created a spiritual community among those people, a community characterized by the bodhicitta, able to work together to alleviate the suffering of the world. And it's interesting to consider the last section of the Bodhicharyavatara, the last thing that he would have recited when he was on that teaching throne, chapter 10, Parinamana, the dedication. Here Shantideva is dedicating the good, the merit that he may have gained through reciting, composing his book for the benefit of all beings. And it's a real heartfelt aspiration. And he mentions so many things that he wants to see happen. He mentions so many different kinds of sufferings that he wants relieved. He wants the hungry fed, the sick healed. He wants there to be abundant harvests, righteous kings, you know, governments were kings in those days, so righteous governments. Even those who are suffering in the hells to be liberated, and that the lonely and the forsaken are befriended. He wishes for people to be rich in culture and learning, and so on and on he goes. But he also says that he wants the monasteries to be full and filled with chanting and study, and that the Sangha, the spiritual communities, should be in harmony with one another. He wishes for the monks and nuns to meditate deeply. He wishes for everybody to be liberated, to attain enlightenment. He even wishes that actually everybody can live in a pure Buddha field, just listening to the Dharma from one of the great Buddhas. And it's a very rich and beautiful section, and like much of Mahayana literature, I think I said this yesterday as well, it's easy to get carried away, it's easy to get wafted away on a kind of opium dream of creating a perfect world. But the bodhisattva ideal must be practiced and lived. These visions, these dreams have got to come down into practicality. A spiritual community inspired by the bodhicitta needs to unite, needs to work together to at least do some of the things that Shantideva aspires to as expressions of living the life of the Dharma. In other bodhisattva texts, we're told that it's a duty, a precept for the bodhisattva to feed the hungry, to tend the sick, to give comfort to the psychologically troubled, to enrich life with culture and festivals and celebrations. And above all, he must make it his duty to communicate the Dharma, as well as to create environments and institutions in which people can come together to practice the Dharma, to work together. All of these things are mentioned. But it's always very clear it must all be done on the basis of practicing the Dharma deeply. It must be done on the basis of the truth, on the basis of reality, on the basis of the bodhicitta. Outside here we have this stupa, which contains the relics of one of Sangharakshita's Tibetan teachers, the Venerable Dado Rinpoche. And Dado Rinpoche was a very great Tibetan Lama. And he ended up starting a school for Tibetan refugees in Kalimpong, which he worked very hard at, because there were so many refugees, so many people coming out who were really, suffering when they came to India. And he wanted to provide for them and to continue to communicate the Dharma and Tibetan culture to them. But it's very interesting, if you look at Rinpoche's day, he'd get up about 4 o'clock in the morning and spend the first few hours of the day meditating, doing puja, doing study. He'd spend the rest of the day involved in organising the school and helping the school run in many ways. That would go on into the evening. And then at night, he'd do another couple of hours of practice and meditation. This, so that everything he did was on the basis of his spiritual practice. It's a very inspiring example. One of the wonderful things about our community, our whole Tri Ratna community, Buddhist community, looking at it and seeing how it's grown in so many different ways, and how these days there are so many different kinds of people working in very different fields. It's one of the wonderful things about the growth of our movement. And I meet many people who in our movement who are working in all sorts of fields to improve people's lives, to alleviate the suffering of others, to enrich human life. There's some amazing people that I meet here at Padmaloka and in other places. But one of the things they tell me is that the Dharma and the inspiration of the bodhicitta has actually improved that work. They are much better at that work of benefiting other people. It's improved their relationships with the people who they work with. It's improved their effectiveness. And I must say, I feel really honoured to be connected with people working in these different fields, and hearing of the worlds in which they work enriches what I do here, inspires the things that I do here. And they find it essential to get away, to come on retreat, or to go to their local centre, or to visit communities, to enjoy an environment in which the conditions are entirely supportive of their spiritual practice and transformation. It's very, very easy to lose one's way when one's really involved in the world, no matter how worthy the cause that we're involved in is. It's very, very easy for old bad habits to take one over. And it can easily, it just then is no longer the bodhisattva work. It's just a job. We just get burnt out and cynical. So we need to fully participate in a community inspired by the bodhicitta. We need to do all that we can, all of us, to strengthen and enrich that spiritual community, to develop and extend it. There are no passive members of a spiritual community. A spiritual community is not a sort of Buddhist support group, where you're just constantly being sort of stroked and, made okay. Everyone needs to be active within the spiritual community. Everybody needs to bring something to the feast, to this particular banquet. So I want to talk a little bit about how we can all do our bit to create a spiritual community inspired by the bodhicitta. Of course, I'm assuming many things. I'm assuming that we're actually inspired by the bodhicitta, that we're committed to living from the bodhicitta and for the bodhicitta, that we're doing all the basic practices, observing the precepts, practicing meditation, developing our wisdom through study, performing puja, all those classics. But what then, over and above all that? Does Shantideva have anything to say about that? Well, yes, of course he does. And I'm going to talk about some of those things under six headings. First of all, taking initiative. Secondly, being a friend. Thirdly, learning from spiritual friends. Fourthly, patience and effort. By the way, patience and effort isn't on your sheets because there's no quote from Shantideva there. That's why that's not there. Fifthly, confessing faults. And six, recollecting the Buddha. I'll just go through these. So first of all, taking initiative. Here's a verse from Shantideva. One should be able and energetic, at all times acting on one's own initiative. In all actions, one should not leave any work to another. The Bodhisattva, those in the Sangha inspired by the Bodhicitta, as I've said, they're not passive. They're able, energetic, and they act on their own initiative. They don't watch others struggling, making an effort, and sit a bit apart, criticising what they do. They get involved. They're alert to what is needed around them, and they plunge in to help. And on this retreat, you can actually do that. There's a work period tomorrow. Yeah, there's the link. You can help enrich the environment here. If you're involved in one of our centres, well, always find out, you know, how you can help, because there's always help needed as a centre. There's always really basic things to do, like cleaning and all that sort of thing, fundraising, so many things. You know, ask the order members who run the centre, well, what can I do? How can I get involved? If you're in a place where there's no centre, there's no Buddhist group, well, talk to order members you know about setting something up. Get them to come to your town, your village, wherever you are, to do something. The first paramita, or perfection, of a bodhisattva is generosity, giving, dana. And this is the absolute basic bodhisattva practice. Actually, it's the basic Buddhist practice. And there are great lists of what can be given, what we need to give. But essentially, it all boils down to just giving ourselves. Giving our time, giving our energy, giving our attention, giving our money. You know, giving whatever we have to enrich the Sangha and the work of the Bodhicitta. And another thing about this, a wonderful thing about this, if you work with other Buddhists, you might not be able to do that all the time, but on some sort of project or other, it's a brilliant way to get to know other people, other Buddhists. It really is the best way to get to know people, to actually work alongside them and share a project. It's much easier, I think, getting to know people like that rather than, you know, the slightly artificial interview type situation. Traditional Bodhisattva texts describe the Bodhisattva as someone who is resourceful, painstakingly resourceful. Bodhisattvas are often described as those who take the lead, not in a competitive, power-hungry sort of way, but as an expression of awareness of what is needed. The Bodhisattva's awareness is right out there. I mean, this is, you know, we often talk about mindfulness and awareness, but very often it gets so sort of focused into the kind of, you know, details of our sort of experience inside. Well, a Bodhisattva's awareness is right out there, taking in the entire environment. He's alert to need. And that's what mindfulness is really all about. Anyway, the first point, take initiative. Secondly, being a friend. So here's Shantideva again. One should give up frowning and grimacing. Be the first to speak, a friend to the universe. One should express one's appreciation of all that is well said. When one sees someone doing good, one should encourage them with praises. One should speak of others' qualities in their absence and repeat them with pleasure. And when one's own praise is spoken, one should reflect on that person's recognition of virtue. One should speak confident, measured words, clear in meaning, delighting the mind, pleasing to the ear, soft and slow, and stemming from love. One should always look at people directly, as if drinking them in with the eye, thinking, depending on them alone, I will attain Buddhahood. Really beautiful verses, some of my favourite verses in the whole of the text. And very human. They actually come from the section on mindfulness, guarding mindfulness. And actually, they describe a friend, a real friend, a friendly person. Shantideva is not content to describe the importance of love and metta and compassion generally. He tries to describe what it will look like day to day. He's describing that the basic friendly open attitude of somebody who's pursuing the Bodhisattva path. He's describing somebody who's really interested in other people, who really takes them in, that lovely phrase, drinking them in with the eye. Really seeing them, not using others to sound off, but opening out to them and speaking with real awareness of them. That lovely phrase, soft, speaking soft and slow and using clear and meaningful words. And Shantideva is recommending this to us all of us in the Sangha. We need to be like this with one another, with everybody, and you know, perhaps especially within the Sangha. And if the Sangha is filled with such mutual, reciprocal attention, when that happens, a real magic starts to happen. It's really in that kind of environment that the Dharma can really come through. It can really start to shine, really start to grow when you get that kind of quality of attention and friendliness in relation to one another. It's well worth looking at the opposite when you have disharmony and division. It's impossible for the Dharma to shine at that time. It's very interesting. You often, it's kind of reassuring in a way. You find that the Buddha often had to deal with disputing disciples, disputing monks who were in disharmony. And very often he would leave them if he couldn't sort of sort them out. If they were so reluctant to really engage in becoming harmonious, he would leave and he wouldn't teach them the Dharma, because there isn't an atmosphere where the Dharma can come through. It's not going to be heard, it's not going to be listened to, because people are so locked into their own positions, their own egotism. So he couldn't teach, he couldn't communicate, that higher dimension couldn't come through in those situations. So friendliness, that kind of quality of friendliness between one another, magnifies our individual efforts. Something greater than the sum of our parts starts to come through. Something like the bodhicitta starts to shine through when you have that quality. So friendliness, friendship, is something we do. You know, sometimes you do hear people complaining in the Sangha, well, no one's my friend. The Sangha is failing me. The Sangha has failed me. You know, you're not good enough or whatever. But sometimes, you know, when people tell me that, I think, well, don't always say it to them. Maybe it's not the right time. Sometimes I do. But I think, well, it's no surprise, actually, because you look so glum and so miserable. You only talk about yourself. You're always complaining. Who wants to be around somebody like that? It's as if sometimes we can expect everybody else to be selfless friends, everybody else to be bodhisattvas. Well, bodhisattvas won't come near to you if they don't see spiritual potential manifesting, if they don't see some sign of, you know, friendliness. They've got so much to do, they're going to concentrate on the people who are taking initiative. So be a friend. You know, really practice that ordinary, straightforward friendliness, being really interested in other people, giving them attention, really opening up to them. It's very interesting. I was in a few seminars and question and answer sessions with Sangharakshita some years ago, and in all of those sessions, they were study groups with order members. There was always a question about insight and wisdom and attainment, and what's it like and who's got it? I mean, that was the sort of implication. And have we even got it in the order? And so on. It would always come up, which is quite interesting in itself. And it was very interesting to see the way Bhante Sangharakshita respond to that. But a number of times, he just launched into a whole thing. He said, well, I get lots of letters from people in our movement who've come into our movement and who've been on a retreat. You know, they've been on a beginner's retreat or they've been on a beginner's course. And they say the teaching was very good and really clear and really helpful and the meditation was very good. But what really moved them and inspired them and made them want to commit themselves to the Dharma was seeing the friendliness in the team of order members and mitras running the class. Their friendliness with one another and the friendliness that they communicated to the people coming to the centre. The harmony, the teamwork, the cooperation, the pleasure they took in that. And as if Bhante was saying, well, actually, that's kind of how you tell whether something good is going on when you have that kind of quality. We can get very carried away with ideas of spiritual attainment and mystical insight. But how does it look? How would somebody who has that, you know, what would they look like? How would they be? So anyway, I found that very interesting. So practicing being a friend. And we can all do that. We can all be a friend. Thirdly, learning from spiritual friends, Kalyana Mitras. When we have this kind of atmosphere of friendliness and friendship, we can learn from spiritual friends, Kalyana Mitras. And what I mean by that, those with greater experience than ourselves. Shantideva says, one should respectfully receive the advice of those who are able to direct others, who offer unsolicited aid. One should be the pupil of everyone all the time. So this verse makes it clear that we aim for a receptive attitude to everybody. We can learn from anybody. But it's also making it clear that it's good to be around people who have more experience than us of practicing the Dharma. And they've been practicing the Dharma for some time. They're rich with the experience of the Dharma. They're rich with the experience of the Sangha, of the spiritual community. They have teachers themselves and spiritual friends themselves. We don't need to have great gurus. We don't need to know, we'll probably never know actually, the exact spiritual attainment of our Kalyana Mitras, our spiritual friends. They're ordinary men who are living the life of the Dharma, inspired by the bodhicitta. They have some knowledge of living the Dharma life, some experience of it. They're friendly people. Well, it's really good to be around such people. It reminds us of what we need to do. Very often it's just their presence that inspires confidence. They even seem to be able to sort of bless the atmosphere when they're around. They communicate confidence in the path, as well as giving us, you know, when we need it, when we want it, when we seek it, some good advice, or at least just help clarify what's going on, you know, so they help us clarify things for ourselves. And meeting spiritual friends can involve, in a way, anything. You can meditate with them, you can talk informally with them to explore the Dharma, you can have fun with them. You can study the Dharma with them in the form of the study group, the Dharma study group. This word study, I think it gives the wrong idea. I think that sometimes people think that it means it's very academic and theoretical. Dharma study group in our context, in our movement, is a spiritual practice. It's not a theory session. We're inspired by the traditional Buddhist term that goes back to the Buddha himself, Dhammakatha, which literally means talking the Dharma, which has been described as a deep, searching, honest, practical exploration of a Dharma text so that it lives now for you. So it's very important to meet with spiritual friends to do this kind of study, this Dhammakatha. And in his book, Shantideva recommends particular texts to study that were important in his day. And they're all texts about a Bodhisattva's conduct, how to live that Bodhisattva life in 8th century India. And he recommends repeated study, and he says one should look in those works of training to find out what to do and what not to do, and thoroughly practice what is recommended in order to guide the mind, guard the mind as you practice in the world. So very, very practical. Sometimes in such study, such talking the Dharma sessions, when everybody's really engaged and really transparent to one another, you seem to move into a different dimension. The Dharma seems to live between everybody. You even start glimpsing the truth of things there in the group. And there's an invigoration that comes through such exploration. And you feel greatly moved to live the Dharma life much more fully. Yes, so Shantideva regards spiritual friends as being of very great importance in our lives. And he says, well, don't give them up. Don't turn away from your spiritual friends. Don't reject them. He says, never. Even at the cost of one's life, should one forsake a spiritual friend who upholds the Bodhisattva vow and who is skilled in the meaning of the Mahayana, the great way to enlightenment for all beings. Spiritual friends are that important. Might not always be straightforward with such spiritual friends. You know, it never is. It rarely is. But you never give them up. If you give them up, you might well be betraying yourself. Because very often, it's the spiritual friend, the Kalyana Mitra of greater experience, who holds for you your spiritual ideals. They remind you of them. And sometimes rejecting your spiritual friend, you're rejecting what is most precious to you. So this brings us to the fourth point, patience and effort. Shantideva has two whole chapters, two long chapters on patience. That's Shanti and effort, Virya. I mean, if I'd had more time for talks, you know, I would have done talks on these. But anyway, we don't have time, so I'm just going to mention them now. But they're very important qualities. Patience is an incredibly important quality. The Bodhisattva certainly really needs it. When I was younger, I could never work out why patience was included. You know, well, why not metta? You know, why patience? Why do you need that? As I've got older, I've got more of a sense of why that's so important. Because there you are, there's the Bodhisattva. He's really working to make a difference in the world. But people aren't interested, or they're indifferent, or even antagonistic. The Bodhisattva might even find that he gets really close to some people, forms very strong friendships. You know, the spiritual community is really humming. But then there's a terrible fallout. People have a reaction to him, a reaction to the Dharma. They turn on him. And it can sometimes be that the Bodhisattva gives an enormous amount to others and then they just leave him. And it's very easy in situations like that to get disheartened, angry, cynical, disappointed. You know, it happens in our own Sangha, in our own spiritual community. People have tiffs, they fall out, there are standoffs, there are rows, people feel let down. But Shantideva is always absolutely clear, there is never, ever any justification for anger, ill will and resentment. If any of those things come into these situations, even when it's completely understandable why you might have that reaction. But if anger, ill will, resentment arises, it just really shows how self-interested one is, how much ego involvement there's been in the Bodhisattva work. So in that sense, it's not really the Bodhisattva work. I mean, I've certainly experienced this myself, and a number of times I've been, you know, upset. You know, I can think of times where I've, you know, really prepared well for a study group. I remember a particular group of order members, and I'd really prepared this material incredibly well. It was a text I loved, and I was really looking forward to exploring it with them, and they were all, you know, good friends of mine, and so on and so forth. But I don't know what was going on, but that particular group, the people were bored. They were, you know, they were dull. They weren't interested. They were reacting to everything I said. I was being really nice and pleasant. But I remember when I left that group, I was so fed up. I was frustrated. I was angry. I was almost in tears. I was thinking, bastards. But all those reactions just showed how precious and immature and, in a sense, how unimaginative I'd been, how unimaginative in my communication. I just held on to my idea of how it should be rather than actually responding to where people were. You know, all that anger and resentment and disappointment, it just showed my own immaturity, my own egotism, my own selfishness. The quality of Kshanti, it means patience, but it implies a great strength as well as a great softness and a continuous quality of forgiveness in relation to the disappointments that go with life. It's a positive acceptance, actually, of how things are. But there's a creative energy there as well. That's the virya, the effort that the bodhisattva needs. Kshanti, patience, isn't a passive state. There's a real wisdom in it. The highest kind of patience is called anutpataka dharma kshanti, the patient acceptance that all things are unborn, unproduced, unmade, which means that in the end that there are no things, that there's nothing substantial. There is just emptiness in the sense of an illusory play, a magical display, bright and brilliant. So the work is play, the difficulties are fun. So in the end, the bodhisattva's kshanti is just this, you know, natural acceptance of things whilst being extraordinarily creative. You know, I think it's well worth reflecting that the bodhisattva path is the wide open path. It's a difficult path because you are committed to other people. Other people will let you down. That goes with the territory. But the bodhisattva always remains open. And I think the other thing that we need to remember is that we will fail in our practice. We will fail in our practice. We will be unskillful. We will be selfish. We will be greedy and stupid and willfully ignorant and lazy. Sometimes a lot. Sometimes we will go through a phase like that, which was seen to last for a very long time. You know, if we didn't have those experiences, we'd be, you know, an irreversible bodhisattva. And of course, we need to be honest about these faults. That's the really important thing. We need to point those faults out to ourselves, even confess them to others, to friends, to spiritual friends. And in the Bodhicharyavatara, Shantideva has a long section called Confession of Evil, Confession of Faults. It's as if the bodhicitta is like a great light, a great sun, that when it shines, it doesn't just, you know, uplift you through that shining, it also throws up and reveals everything in us that is the polar opposite of the bodhicitta. You know, we're going to have some verses of confession in our we have it regularly in our puja, but we're going to have a lot of long confessional verses this evening. Shantideva describes the bodhicitta as being like the great fire that destroys the world at the end of the eon. This is a traditional part of Indian Buddhist cosmology, that the world system goes up in a massive conflagration at the end of a world age. So the bodhicitta is like a great fire at the end of the world age. In an instant, it completely destroys great evils. So yes, tonight we are going to have a confession puja. So do remember to make a note of your regrets and also make a note of your resolutions. And these will be ritually burnt up in the conflagration. So confession, we confess in order to clear the way for the bodhicitta to shine more brightly, shine more brightly in the Sangha. The Sangha should be a place where we feel we can confess and acknowledge our faults. The Sangha, in that sense, should be a place where we can be fully ourselves, where we can be honest about our failings and able to give full voice, full expression to our aspiration. So this brings me to the last of the points, the sixth point, recollecting the Buddha, or recollecting the Bodhisattva, or recollecting the Bodhicitta. It's all of these things. Recollecting, remembering, opening up to that force of wisdom and compassion. Not as an idea, but as a living presence. We have all these images here in the shrine room, and the Buddha image here. We have all these things here in order to recollect the living presence, the living force of wisdom and compassion. All these images are really doorways and gateways into that presence, or through which that presence shines, through which the bodhicitta, or shunyata karuna garbha, the essence of voidness and compassion, can shine. Because in the end, the bodhicitta is this essence of voidness and compassion. It's actually, in the end, it's voidness because it's on beyond all representation and description. In classic Buddhist text, the ultimate bodhicitta is described as voidness, shunyata, emptiness, perfumed by compassion. So that means it's beyond all representation, beyond all telling, beyond all knowing, actually. But although it's beyond all representation, it comes to us in the most beautiful and the most meaningful of forms. It speaks to us through the most beautiful and meaningful of forms. You notice that in Shantideva's text. He describes the bodhicitta in all sorts of ways. Just trying to, you know, that's the way he's describing this thing that's beyond all expression, in images, in metaphors, in myths and symbols. So it's really important to find that bodhicitta, to find its living presence in our life. Find that form that expresses it to you. Find that vital energy, that vital spark, that vital current, that tremendous energy called bodhicitta, that highly potent quicksilver elixir, which is mysterious and magical. Without that real bodhicitta presence, that real presence of the bodhicitta, we don't really have a spiritual community. Not really. We might be good people, but we're not that transcendental force for good. And you can't really teach and, in a sense, learn how to be with that living presence of the bodhicitta. All you can do is set up the conditions for it through our practices, our different practices, and wait for that touch of what cannot be weighed and known and measured. For Shantideva, the bodhicitta, the essence of voidness and compassion, came particularly in the form of Manjugosha, the sweet-voiced, or Manjushri, the gentle radiance. It came in that form. It came in the form of his spiritual friends. And the last words of his Bodhicharyavatara are about Manjugosha, who he also calls Manjunata, the gentle protector. It's very significant that he ends by referring to Manjugosha and Manjunata and his Kalyanamitra, his spiritual friend, his human Kalyanamitra. So we're going to end with Shantideva's words. Through being embraced by Manjugosha, may I always gain entry into the spiritual community. May I recollect my former births until I reach the stage of great joy. May I remain full of strength in whatever I do. In all my lives, may I acquire the means for retreat. When I desire to see anything or ask anything, may I see and hear without obstruction the protector Manjunata himself. May my own conduct emulate the conduct of Manjushri, who works to achieve the welfare of all living beings throughout the 10 directions of space. As long as space abides, and as long as the world abides, so long may I abide, destroying the sufferings of the world. Whatever suffering is in store for the world, may it all ripen in me. May the world find happiness through all the pure deeds of the Bodhisattvas. The sole medicine for the ailments of the world, the mine of all success and happiness, may the teaching of the Buddha, with all honour and glory, endure till the end of time. I bow down to Manjugosha, through whose inspiration my mind turns to the good. I honour the spiritual friend, through whose inspiration the good grows strong.